President Trump is visiting Iowa today to highlight advancements in high-tech agriculture. How has Iowa's support for Trump changed in his 5 months in office? Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Bruce Nesmith of Coe College with us today. Their thoughts on the president's visit and much more, including Russia probe hearings today on Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans step on the gas pedal to try and pass a repeal of Obamacare, the Supreme Court to hear a case on partisan gerrymandering with potentially huge consequences, and thoughts on foreign policy during the Trump presidency. Discussion for Politics Day. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. With us today, Bruce Nesmith, the Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Coe College. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Ben.
Jim McCormick with us as well, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
Great to have you gentlemen with us as we pick apart politics over the last few days, including how Senate Republicans are stepping on the gas pedal to try and pass a repeal of Obamacare as soon as next week. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Also, a Supreme Court case. It's agreed to hear a case on partisan gerrymandering. I think potentially huge potential consequences. We'll ask our guests about that, some thoughts on foreign policy and developments there. Takeaways from the Republican victory in Georgia, also South Carolina, and the Russian probe hearings going on as we speak on Capitol Hill in Washington. But first of all, gentlemen, let's talk about President Trump returning to Iowa. Actually, not returning as president, because this is Donald Trump's first visit to Iowa as president. He returns to Iowa during the administration's Tech Week, week meant to draw attention to technological innovations in the ag sector here in Iowa. This evening, he'll be holding a campaign-sponsored rally at the U.S. Cellular Center in Cedar Rapids. River to River listeners, let's hear from you. Are you going to see the president's rally this evening in Cedar Rapids? Are you perhaps protesting it? We could hear from you as well on that count. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps a challenge to Trump supporters listening. Donald Trump won Iowa by 9 percentage points. How satisfied are you as a Trump supporter, as someone who supported him in the polls in November with his first 5 months in office? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Well, Bruce and Jim, let's get your thoughts on the president returning to Iowa to speak at Kirkwood Community College. Also, Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue and Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross also in Iowa today, along with the president. An event today that will also serve as a send-off of sorts for Iowa Governor Terry Branstad, who was confirmed last month as Donald Trump's ambassador to China. Jim McCormick, your thoughts on why Donald Trump is visiting Iowa now?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons why he would come to Iowa. I mean, first of all, obviously, in terms of talking about tech innovation in the agricultural sector, which is very important. And I think it's of interest that he brings along two cabinet members and now the ambassador to China as well with this event. But I think there's a second reason, of course. President Trump loves these kind of getting beyond the beltway to speak to some of his supporters to kind of reinvigorate himself. So I think it in terms of his own agenda here. Mm-hmm. So I think they're really it serves a couple different purposes here.
Bruce, let me ask you this. A campaign style rally 5 months into his presidency. Why is this unusual for a president to do this?
maybe not entirely, but certainly to the extent that Trump has done it. But I think he's, as Jim suggested, he's very good at these kind of spectacles, and he's very good at campaigning. Mm-hmm. Maybe not so good at being president.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Nesmith, how solid do you judge Donald Trump's support here in Iowa 5 months after the state went for him in a big way?
Well, I haven't seen any polling, so that kind of diminishes my authority on this question. But I think what we've seen nationally is that there's been very little melting of his support. I think in polls, maybe, late 2016, early 2017, he might have been 3 or 5 percentage points above where he is right now. But there has not been a lot of volatility, not been a lot of loss of support nationally. And I'm kind of guessing that's probably true in Iowa as well.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, do you see it the same way in terms of the support holding up for Donald Trump?
I do. I particularly see it holding up among his political base here. That has been a kind of a national trend. I mean, there's been some erosion among Republican supporters, but it still remains quite high. I mean, the CBS News had a poll the other day that showed his approval rating overall was down to 36%, but among Republicans, it was still holding pretty firm, although it had been some decline at 72%. So, there is still, I think, this base level of support early on in his administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, that gives us an opportunity to talk about the special elections yesterday in Georgia and South Carolina, both won by the Republicans. Georgia Republican Karen Handel won the most expensive congressional race in history, avoiding a Democratic upset in a race that was widely seen as a referendum on Donald Trump. The margin of her win, 52% to 48%, the former Georgia Secretary of State defeating Democrat John Ossoff. He was a political newcomer trying to gain control of this Atlanta district that has elected Republicans to Congress since the 1970s. Let's listen to a little bit of Karen Handel's victory speech, winning the 6th district in Georgia in this special election. In her victory speech last night, she talked briefly about the shooting last week at a congressional baseball practice in Virginia. She highlighted what she sees as a need for civility.
Really and truly, what happened on that ball field was a terrible tragedy. And we need to all continue to lift up Steve and the others who were injured that day. And we need to also lift up this nation so that we can find a more civil way to deal with our disagreements. Because in these United States of America, no one should ever feel their life threatened over their political beliefs and positions. And I say that, ladies and gentlemen, in regards to both sides of the political aisle.
Okay, Karen Handel winning yesterday in Georgia. So the significance here, the takeaways for you, Bruce Nesmith, the Democrats are 0-4, 3-4, or maybe more in special elections since Trump took
office.
4
by my count, anyway.
4 by your count. Okay, very good.
Montana, Kansas, Georgia, and South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. What's the takeaway for you here on this last one?
I reserve judgment. That's an enormous amount of money to pour into a race and not get the seat. So that I think has maybe more implications than just losing it. But I think the big question is, how does it affect elections going forward, and particularly how does it affect candidacies? I think there was some research, longstanding congressional elections research by Gary Jacobson and others, that say that the incumbent advantages do a lot to scaring off potential challengers. And while Ossoff might have overperformed the Democratic normal vote in that district, still he didn't win. And the donors who contributed his campaign didn't get a seat out of it. So that, if to the extent that that suggests to other Democratic candidates and donors that 2018 they might do better than average, but still not going to win the, you know, gain the seats or gain the Congress, that could have a very depressive effect then on Democratic performance.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, do you see any silver linings in this outcome, which was admittedly a disappointment, of course, for the Democrats, but, you know, coming to within 4 percentage points of ousting someone in a Republican seat?
Well, it was long-held Republican seat. I mean, I know that the media talks about Trump only winning the district by 1 percentage point, but Tom Price, the former congressman from that district, won it by, I think, 20 points here. I think the problem for the Democrats is, and it really was demonstrated with, even with Ossoff's candidacy, is exactly what message are they going to pursue in these districts that they think they might have a chance. Are they going to pursue an anti-Trump message, or are they going to try to pursue a sign of a middle ground message? And what I've been reading about this is that Ossoff tried both strategies, and maybe that was a serious error in terms of kind of rallying support and getting any kind of crossover votes here. I think that's an important lesson for Democrats to take out of it. What message is there one consistent message that they're going to pursue in terms of the 2018 campaign?
Mm-hmm. And do you have, Jim, a feeling on the tack that you think would be most likely to achieve success for the Democratic Party?
I think the anti-Trump message will probably be more persuasive than trying to go for the middle voters here. I think there's probably the kind of visceral reaction to Trump is likely to spur some support or at least to turn some voters rather than trying to use I hate to say this to the political scientists, but the issue kind of positions.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Bruce Nesmith of Coe College, as we discuss on here on Politics Wednesday. And Donald Trump's first visit to Iowa as president today, later tonight, a campaign style rally, asking you to weigh in on that with your thoughts. Perhaps you're a Donald Trump supporter. Has your support wavered, changed at all in his 5 months in office? 1-866-780-9100. Michael with us in Cedar Rapids. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Michael.
Hey there.
What do you want to chip in? Thanks for calling.
Oh, no problem. Love the show. I just wanted to say that Iowa did go for Trump in the election, but it was more because of the rural areas kind of went for him. Anywhere there is a population, like colleges, cities, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, for instance, we did not go for Trump at all. And we kind of feel like we're in a little island here. So, everyone that did vote for Trump, from friends I know, they're still with him. And everyone that was against Trump is definitely still against Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to let that be known.
Right. Michael, you're calling from Cedar Rapids. If stepping outside, or is there a buzz around Cedar Rapids with the president coming today?
Oh, actually, yeah, there is, especially around Kirkwood. They shut down that whole part of the campus. I work there. I'm not allowed to even go into that part of the campus today.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right. Michael, thanks for your view from Cedar Rapids.
Thank you.
1-866-780-9100. Bruce, that's also your part of the state there, too. Is it true? We have little bastions of parts of the state that did not support Trump, even though Trump won easily, handily in the state, right?
Yes, and I think that's true of most states, at least most battleground states, is that urban areas tend to be more Democratic and small town / rural areas tend to be more Republican.
Mm-hmm. Jim, why would that be? Rural parts of the country, including rural parts of Iowa, left behind, so to speak, by some of the globalization taking place?
Well, I think the rural areas, too, have largely a more independent kind of streak among the populace here. Urban areas tend to benefit more from governmental programs, it seems to me, although you could talk about farm subsidies here. But I think there's probably more the view of how government can be a positive influence in some urban areas, and that generally accrues to support for Democrats.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's move on to what's happening on Capitol Hill today, what has been happening, Russia's efforts to interfere in last year's elections, front and center during two hearings on Capitol Hill today. Let's hear a little bit of the goings-on. Officials from the Department of Homeland Security were answering questions this morning from the Senate Intelligence Committee. Chairman Richard Burr asked the Acting Deputy Undersecretary of Cybersecurity, Jeanette Manfra, about why there hasn't been more specifics about the places targeted. She said she can't disclose which states were targeted. Manfra says that it's important to protect the confidentiality and trust with the community. She says the attack on the technical information from a victim and make it anonymous, and then it's shared across the country to help warn and protect other election systems. Let's listen to a little bit of what she had to say testifying today.
We believe that this has been a very important key to our success in developing trusted relationships across all of the 16 critical infrastructure sectors.
Are we prepared today to say publicly how many states were targeted?
We, as of right now, we have evidence of 21 states, or election-related systems in 21 states that were targeted.
But in no case were actual vote tallies altered in any way, shape, or form.
That is correct.
Okay, as far as we know now, right, Jim, 21 states targeted, no vote tallies changed. That's what we know right now, right?
Absolutely. What's startling to me when I heard the number of 21 states, I mean, it was really, really much more pervasive than I guess I had assumed up to this juncture. And that may not even be the whole story. It may even be beyond that. So I think in terms of the kind of activities of Russian hackers or people that were employed apparently by Russian hackers is much broader than maybe we have been led to believe so far.
Mm-hmm. Senator Angus King, an independent, says it's, in his words, the most serious attack in the U.S. since 9/11. Bruce Nesmith, do you believe that's true?
I don't know. I don't know what your metric would be. We've certainly been blessed not to have a serious physical attack by terrorists in the 16 years ensuing. In terms of financial stuff, I don't know. But
well,
you know,
I mean, undermining our democracy. We could potentially have had a president elected and then discover lately that the vote tally was actually changed to, I don't know, does our Constitution have any way to deal with that?
Not really. I mean, I think that the Constitution and democracy and capitalism and all the systems that go on in America rely at least to some degree on faith that the system is operating as it should. And even if vote totals weren't affected, if people think that they were affected or they think in the next election they might be affected, then that causes a damage to the faith in the system that the system requires.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, let me have you address the interesting quirk here in this. We have a president who doesn't necessarily acknowledge, in fact, quite the opposite, to calling it a hoax that we have Russian meddling. There have been twists and turns over the past year in this unfolding story of the alleged ties to Russia, Russian influence in our election. One thing has remained consistent. Donald Trump blames the Democrats, not the Russians. Says it's a hoax, fake news. How do you interpret that, Jim? Do you believe our president really doesn't believe the consensus of 17 intelligence agencies?
Actually, I don't believe that. I suspect there's, you know, some political posturing going on here, and political partisanship is very much at play. I think just to add one thing to what Bruce said, I think he's really accurately talked about this. But what really this highlights is, and I think the American public will really want to take notice of this, is how much cybersecurity, how much we are dependent on cybersecurity, and how much this has to be an area that we sort of expand our attention to. And frankly, governments at all levels and institutions at all levels really pay proper attention to cybersecurity, because we're so dependent upon the sort of the internet and computer systems here.
Mm-hmm. And so when we look back, I mean, your remarks give me the impression that when we look back in 10 or 20 years, we'll look back to this first big moment in sort of cyber warfare that affects elections as, wow, we were naive then. And I think so.
And we may have even missed some earlier on. I mean, I don't want to raise any hackles, but maybe there was, you know, I wouldn't have any doubt that in earlier elections there were attempts at this kind of hacking, if you will, by let's say, sinister forces here. So, but I think this will be a turning point. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. The future threat here, well, if the Russians were trying to change votes, that's one thing. But if they weren't trying to change votes, Jim, what were they up to?
I think they wanted, I mean, what again, the little bit I've read on this, they were trying to get sort of voting lists and so on, and maybe just explore how the system works, maybe with future efforts in mind here. I think, as some officials have said, because the voting machines are not really hooked up to the internet, it would be very difficult for them to make changes in actual voting outcomes. And of course, some states have paper ballots that they can that they can cross-check what the computer tallies show. So I think that probably what we'll see is that there'll be more safeguards built in, should be more safeguards built into the electoral process.
Okay, Jim and Bruce, just a couple minutes before we take a short break. Sue is with us in Ames, listening in Ames. I'll have to ask you to please make it brief. Sue, we have a break coming up, but what's on your mind?
I'm just curious, as an independent who didn't support Trump but was hopeful that we'd see some results from the administration, do you think there's any rhetoric or missteps? I pose the question to your guests that current President Trump could make that would...
Sorry, Sue, I think we lost you there. But to finish, I think your thought here, why haven't the missteps, Bruce Nesmith, damaged the president's support in worse ways than they have, at least according to our polls?
Well, I think part of it is that people who voted for Trump supported certain policies or outcomes that they're still hopeful of getting and didn't think that the Democrats would provide. And I think the other is the diversity of media that we rely on. So comparing it to the 1970s with Watergate, we were all sort of sipping from the same information cup, and that's no longer true.
Right, certainly not the days in the 70s. I remember taking in my first political broadcast in the 70s, three networks, three commercial networks, PBS, NPR in its infancy. We'll continue our discussion on this Politics Day with Bruce Nesmith of Coe College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. I'd like to have you join on the day that Donald Trump makes his first visit to Iowa as president. What are your thoughts? What are your questions for our political analysts? Back in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
We're back midstream in this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University. Our other analyst, Bruce Nesmith of Coe College. We'd like you to join our conversation on this day when Donald Trump makes his first visit to Iowa as president. He'll be in Cedar Rapids visiting Kirkwood Community College, focusing on agricultural innovation. Also, later tonight at the U.S. Cellular Center, a campaign-style rally. We'd like you to join us, especially if you supported Donald Trump, to give us your questions, your comments on perhaps how your support for the president has evolved in the 5 months that he's been in office. 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about more business in Washington that we've been talking about for a few weeks, Jim and Bruce. Yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell formally setting an ambitious schedule for his conference to repeal and replace Obamacare, promised his members to get draft legislation on Thursday with a floor vote next week. McConnell says Republicans have debated the issue long enough, and he expects to have a cost projection and analysis from the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, by early next week. Bruce, tell us here, how nervous do you believe Republicans are that they're going to muster the votes to get this, you know, this is a campaign priority promise for several years by Republicans, also by Donald Trump, and McConnell can only afford a couple of defections. How nervous do you think Senate Republicans are?
Well, they don't sound nervous. It sounds to me like they're expecting to go ahead. I'm not really sure what nervous sounds like, but I think they, with that specific of a timetable, it sounds like they think they've got everybody in line.
Mm-hmm. If they're going ahead, Jim, does that mean the ducks are there in a line for Mitch McConnell?
Oh, I would assume so. I don't think that, you know, McConnell's pretty cautious, and I wouldn't think that he would bring up the bill if he didn't have the votes, although there is this kind of time pressure with the 4th of July recess coming up, and I'm sure he wants to get some action done. But I would think that he's probably got his head count right.
Of course, a lot of talk about how this bill is being crafted behind closed doors by a small group of senators, the conference there. Let's listen to Senator Grassley, our U.S. senator here in Iowa. He says there will be enough time to review the bill before the vote.
When it comes to understanding what's in this bill, whether it's 122 pages or 200 pages, but a lot less than 2,700 pages that was in Obamacare, you got to remember we've been debating what's wrong with Obamacare for 7 years, and all these problems have been studied thoroughly.
Okay, is the press making too much of this, Jim? That it's being crafted behind closed doors as if something sinister was happening? Is this unusual to do this? Or Senator Grassley saying, hey, there's plenty of time to review this. We have, after all, been talking about the same sort of things for years and looking at where Obamacare is deficient.
I don't think the media is wrong to talk about open and transparency in terms of crafting the legislation, but I think it will be incumbent upon Republicans once they do release the bill, apparently tomorrow, that they do allow sufficient time for it to be reviewed and maybe amended and so on. I mean, McConnell has promised several votes on amendments and so on. I think it's right to talk about the openness of it. After all, as Senator Grassley said, the Affordable Care Act was 2,700 pages, and you know Nancy Pelosi made that rather famous statement that we have to pass the bill first before we can find out what's in it. So I hope the Republicans are doing it the other way around.
Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University, Bruce Nesmith of Coe College. Yesterday, the White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer declined to deny reports that he will transition into some sort of behind-the-scenes role, helping the White House, and also that he's helping the White House search for a replacement, suggesting he might not keep his current gig. Now, he's been in office, he's held his job for about 150 days and counting. He was asked by a reporter yesterday about a possible shakeup in the White House Communications Department.
There are reports that your role is changing here at the White House. I wanted to know if you can address those reports. Are they true or not? And if so, can you tell us what's in store?
Right here. So you can keep taking your selfies and saw a few folks. But look, it's no secret we've had a couple of vacancies, including our communications director, that's gone for a while. We've been seeking input from individuals as far as ideas that they have. We've been meeting with potential people that, that may be of service to this administration. I don't think that should come as any surprise. But we're always looking for ways to do a better job of articulating the president's message and his agenda. And we'll continue to have those discussions internally. When we have an announcement of a personnel nature, we'll let you know.
Okay, should Sean Spicer leave in the near future? Bruce Nesmith, how would you characterize what he will be known for?
Trying really hard to articulate what is going on in President Trump's head, which cannot be easy.
Jim, so the reason Sean Spicer has gained so much attention here, just speculation over him leaving has gained a lot of attention. Is it because of his performance or more because of the unorthodox president he is serving?
Well, I suppose both are at stake here, but I think his performance here, from the sort of the get-go, he got off on the wrong foot in terms of, the size of the crowd at the inauguration and so on. And, he's become, a source of parody by, I guess, Saturday Night Live and so on. So I think that has hurt his efforts even to recoup here his status. So I suspect what that message yesterday was really that there will be an announcement in the near term, and that he will, the speculation is that he'll take over the communications organization within the White House and be less a public figure here.
Can you imagine any successor to Sean Spicer doing a better job? I'm just trying to figure that out. We've been hearing speculation about how this is a tough position to fill, given the circumstances of it under Donald Trump. How could someone have done a better job, you think, Jim?
Well, you're right. It has been a challenge because sometimes you get the tweets that the president has made that either contradict, the kind of statements that he wants to set out in the public forum, he takes a different tack and so on. So that has become a real problem here. So, but I think probably a change in personnel here actually might give that new person a new chance, and maybe the media will also give that person a little bit of a honeymoon, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about this case that the Supreme Court announced it would consider. I think in the fall they'll be hearing it, whether partisan gerrymandering violates the Constitution. What is gerrymandering? We talk about it a lot on our Politics Wednesdays especially. Well, over the years, going way back, it turns out, to the early 1800s, lawmakers have become ever more sophisticated in redrawing legislative maps after each census. Each census after each decade. They carve out these oddly shaped districts for state legislatures and houses of representatives that favor their party's candidates. Now, this new case, accepted by the High Court on Monday, is an appeal of a decision striking down the legislative map for the Wisconsin State Assembly that was drawn after the Republicans gained control of that state's government in 2010. It's a decision it's the first time that the federal court rejected a voting map as unconstitutional for partisan gerrymandering. Now, we've been able to do it for other reasons, right, Bruce? We cannot allow politicians to redraw districts to favor or disfavor, discriminate against racial groups, right? That's been established.
That is, yes. And the districts have to be substantially equal in size. You can't draw big districts and small districts, things like that. But parties have never been found to be threatened by equal protection or lack of equal protection if there are too many of them or too few of them in a district.
Mm-hmm. How significant would this be, Jim? if the U.S. Supreme Court said, just like in the case of race, it can't be gerrymandered to favor one party or the other?
I think it would be incredibly significant, because you look at the number of states which where the partisan organizations, or at least the state legislatures, make decisions. I think I looked at the number this morning. There are something like 37 states where the state legislature makes the decision on this. This would really be a profound change. It would again take, which voting has been, and the control of voting has been basically at the state level. This would really make, really nationalize, if you will, the whole political process, and further erode, it seems to me, any kind of state authority here. So I think it would be profound, have a profound effect on the political arrangements that we have. I mean, some of the data show that, with this kind of political gerrymandering that it can occur, you can get maybe up to 90% or 80% of the seats with not having anywhere near that amount of the vote. So it would have a profound effect both on the state level and sort of state assemblies and state government, but it would also have on congressional districts. So a decision here, I think, could be really earth-shattering.
Mm-hmm. A fun historical...
Could I add something?
Yes, absolutely, Bruce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another factor would be that more maps would be litigated. A lot of them are litigated now, but more maps would be litigated because, depending on what the standard was for how much variation you could allow, how much gerrymandering was permissible and when it crossed the line. That would be another layer of complexity to the districting process every 10 years.
And it would give, again, more authority, it seems to me, to the federal court system rather than to the states. In most instances.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
A fun historical fact here that I didn't know until I did some research on it this morning. The term gerrymandering, where does it come from? Well, it was coined after Elbridge Gerry, Massachusetts governor, signed in 1812 a law that included a voting district shaped like a salamander to help electoral prospects of his party. So they combined his last name, Gerry, with salamander and got gerrymander. So now you know, for all the social events you're going to, you are one leg up on the others in politics.
You just won on Jeopardy, too.
You just won on Jeopardy as well. Let's talk a little bit about foreign policy. Our time is disappearing on us. Monday of this week, Russia officially suspending the hotline, the so-called hotline between Moscow and Russia and Washington, coming after that U.S. military jet shot down a Syrian Air Force jet. Jim, how significant is this deterioration in Russia-U.S. relations?
Well, I think it is significant. I mean, it's happened once before. There was a temporary suspension. You might remember after the United States made this attack upon Syria, this strike on Syria a few months ago. But I think that not having that kind of cooperation has the potential of more accidents. And there was also an incident in the Baltics that I think is not unrelated to this, where a Russian jet flew very close to an American reconnaissance plane here. So I think we're into some dangerous territory here when we don't have this kind of communication going on.
Let's go back to the phones. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Running out of time, Jim, but please ask your question, make your point. Welcome to the program.
Well, I was listening earlier, and I keep hearing this thing about Russian interference, the attempt to delegitimize the Trump administration or the election by implying that the Russians hacked the election, for which there is no evidence. There is an assertion that the 16 or 17 or however many intelligence agencies all agreed on this, which is absurd on its face. To assert that the DEA and the Coast Guard did an intensive investigation into whether Russia hacked the DNC is silly. And anybody who says that is either ignorant or dishonestly trying to influence the opinion of the bulk of the population, which are ignorant. That assertion was brought out by 22 handpicked people from the CIA, the NSA, and the FBI.
We're running out of time. Jim in Dubuque, let's get a comment about that. What do you have to say, Bruce and Jim, to skeptics that claim that the Russian meddling and interference is just, as I guess Jim would agree with the president's view, it's a hoax?
Well, I don't know. That may explain why, you know, the core support is holding. If there's no information, no new information that can convince you of something that you don't believe, then there's nothing really that is going to convince you.
Mm-hmm. Jim,
I think you have to separate out some of these things here. I mean, the whether there was hacking, I don't think is the intelligence agencies seem to be as one on that this has occurred. The question is about collusion, which I think is the president has most dramatically challenged here. So I think you have to separate out some of
things. But to Jim's point there, his pushback there, is there any doubt that the Russians did hack emails and then to send them through WikiLeaks, were trying to put their thumb on the scale on behalf of Donald Trump in this last election, Jim?
Well, I think there is at least a lot of evidence that maybe not Russia directly, but maybe through some intermediary was able to pass on things to WikiLeaks here. And I think that despite President Putin's denial, I think the Russians probably wanted Trump in office here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go back to a little bit of foreign policy before we have to wind this up. Jim, you just got back from Hong Kong on Sunday, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You were there for a conference. Hong Kong preparing for a 20th anniversary of its return to Chinese sovereignty under this one country, two systems principle. We don't have much time, but explain this unique political arrangement and where it finds itself now.
Well, this goes back to 1997 when the lease that the British had on Hong Kong expired, and it was actually turned over, and they made a 50-year agreement which allowed for one country, two systems here. And right now, as of July 1st, they're going to have an anniversary celebration in Hong Kong of the 20th anniversary of this. But what I was struck with is the sort of pervasiveness of Chinese really control here, despite this kind of idea of one country and two systems, that there really is, I think, increased kind of intrusion of any kind of independence, if you will, mm-hmm. on the part of Hong Kong by the Chinese government. And Xi Jinping is actually going to make a visit to Hong Kong for that July 1st celebration.
Mm-hmm. Are protests, for instance, allowed by residents?
Well, that's a good question that you asked, because there's all this effort now, because they're having actually a change in government in Hong Kong as of July 1st as well. And the whole impetus now is to pass a new national security law. They had tried before. They were unsuccessful because of protests. But there's a new government that comes along, and apparently its priority is to get a new national security law, which in effect would dampen and maybe even eliminate, depending on the exact language, the possibility of that we saw a few years ago of where they had the so-called umbrella revolution there in Hong Kong. So I think there's been, at least in my mind, there's been a tightening of control here.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before we go, Jim, let me lean on you as our foreign policy expert briefly again here before the hour is out. The death of the American college student Otto Warmbier this week. This is days after his release from 17 months of detention in North Korea. Adding some new challenges into dealing with North Korea and its dictator Kim Jong-un. Now, Donald Trump calling the treatment of Warmbier a total disgrace in a tweet. Here's his tweet. While I greatly appreciate the efforts of President Xi and China to help with North Korea, it has not worked out. At least I know China tried. Jim, an interesting tweet there. Has Donald Trump given up on China being able to influence the North Koreans in regard to their nuclear weapons?
Actually, I would read that tweet as an appeal once again to China to really come through, because they don't want to look like they've It seems to me that, China would not want to look like it failed on that. But I think that, you know, the death of this student is just absolutely despicable, and it obviously just really reinforces the view that the North Korean government has virtually no respect for human rights here. And it's going to increase if it's at all possible in terms of American sanctions against the North Koreans. Whether it will be enough to motivate the Chinese, I'm still doubtful, because the Chinese are so fearful of what would happen to the Korean Peninsula, and having an unfriendly government of, say, South Korea or United Korea on their border here. So I think that's really the issue that remains.
Mm-hmm. If we were to have the hotspots for U.S. foreign policy all in a list here, would North Korea be at the top of that list, Jim?
Absolutely, because of the nuclear weapons danger that North Korea poses. I think that has to be, and I think even outgoing President Obama told incoming President Trump that was going to be the major challenge here. And trying to resolve this and trying to get some movement on this is the key. I mean, the South Korean government, of course, has with a change in government there, has talked about exploring maybe talks. But again, that's been tried in the past. I remain skeptical.
Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, Bruce Nesmith, the Joan and Abbott Lipsky professor of political science at Coe College. Bruce and Jim, thank you for your time, for your insights, and we'll look forward to welcoming you onto a future Politics Wednesday of our program.
Thank you very much.
Great talking with you both.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.